So we're on to sort of the fourth state of matter, right? Which is
yes.
Ordered phases. We've covered all the other states, I guess, by now. So, I've been in this field for a long time and have collaborated with a number of people, some of whom you probably know. But actually, I haven't been doing experiments in this area since I came to Penn State, particularly. So. That means I don't have any PhD students in this particular area. Okay, so what do I mean by structured fluid? There's got to be some local order. So that order could be pneumatic, it could be a lamellar block copolymer. And the commonality in all of these things is that they have some sort of a defect texture, for lack of a better word. And so that what that means is that there's pieces of the material. My background is in material science, so I draw these things like grains in a metal. And over here, the pneumatic director or the layers or whatever are lined up in one direction. And in some other region, they're lined up in another direction, and there's no particular correlations between these various directions in different grains. And at least in the quiescent state, it's obvious that there's one length scale that describes this defect texture. Now, when we shear on the material, and we're going to then stretch out this defect texture in some very anisotropic fashion and maybe have the director going like this or something, then it's not quite so obvious that there's one length scale. Yet the models that I'm going to tell you are very simple-minded scaling models that are going to assume that there's just one important length scale. And so I would say the important length scale in this case would be this distance here, as opposed to whatever the length is, because basically, in my view of things, defects have to traverse across this domain to get relaxation on very long time scales or large length scales.
Sorry, you said the short length is the important one, is it, or long length is the
same? I think it's the short one, yeah.
Can you repeat again why?
Because my view is that for these sorts of things to be able to relax, what has to happen is defects, I focus actually on line defects, have to move from one boundary to the other. And it's true they could move in this direction, but that's going to take a lot longer than moving in this direction. But it's not obvious, and so you know, we have this all-powerful scaling method that falls flat on its face if we have more than one length scale, and I don't have any other tools to offer. I'm going to skip most of the introduction to my talk because I think people in this audience probably know what liquid crystals are and mostly know what rheological methods are. But I thought I'd keep this slide out of my introduction just because it focuses on the two possibilities for terminal response of any material in rheology, according to John Ferry, who wrote the Bible in viscoelasticity. And those two possibilities are we can have a viscoelastic liquid or we can have a viscoelastic solid. And they have very different character. So if we do our oscillatory shearing experiment, for the liquid, of course, G double prime dominates and has a slope of 1, and G prime has a slope of 2 in the terminal region. And for the solid, G prime is dominating and independent of frequency at low frequencies. And so those are very different responses, and we can easily, just by curve matching, shape matching, decide whether we have a liquid or a solid. It's a little bit harder to think about in steady shear, particularly for the solid, because that's not a usual experiment that we apply to solids. But in the solids I'll talk about today, it's an easy experiment to do because some of these solids are actually pourable. So for the liquid, of course, the viscosity is independent of shear rate at low rates. And for the solid, the stress is effectively independent of shear rate. It only depends on strain for a solid, right? That's Hooke's law. And so that gives us a minus one slope for the apparent viscosity as a function of shear rate.
Ralph, I hope you're not going to necessarily persuade us, particularly in the light of the cartoon on the blackboard you've drawn, that your materials will fall into those. I mean, that's not a complete class of all possible real materials, right?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, some people who are far smarter than I have proposed that there are other terminal responses for viscoelastic materials, such as, these would then fall into two limiting cases. And you might imagine, if you have a vivid imagination, you might imagine that you could have a power law response, for instance, which would fall in between these two possibilities. And so then we would get some anomalous exponent, like a half or something in here. And I would argue that's perfectly all right. You can see that. And in fact, there are data that support it. But you haven't gone to low enough rates yet. And eventually, your material will decide whether it's a liquid or a solid when you go to low enough rates.
Or it might age.
Yes.
OK.
But what you're saying, that why can't you have a material that has something
This I will get to, yeah. Have to be patient. Okay. So, the first material I'd like to look at is a smectic liquid crystalline polymer. It has the chemical structure here, and this is sort of typical of main chain liquid crystalline polymers. So there's a fairly rigid looking thing, and then there's a quite flexible thing. So this may come out a little bit small, but there's a 10 there. So there are 10 carbons in that flexible spacer. And so since the rigid part doesn't particularly like the flexible part, they separate into layers and you get a smectic phase. And here are the rheological properties at very low strain amplitudes. And I'll show you in the next slide that actually corresponds to linear viscoelastic response. And we have clearly a solid for this smectic, in that G prime at the lowest frequencies we can conveniently access is independent of frequency. Yes?
It's slowly evolving, the frequency.
Yes, absolutely.
Is this just as dumped into the geometer or aligned in some way?
It is molded in a compression mold, as we would mold a thermoplastic polymer, and not aligned in any way whatsoever.
There are 10 temperatures.
Did you use 10 temperatures?
No. This is all at one temperature, 240 degrees, which is in the smectic phase.
Does it depend on the history of what you do with the sample, like if you shear it for a while and repeat again?
Oh, absolutely.
So this is as from a particular history you got this.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, we have to, to make sure we get to the right equilibrium temperature and everything, we have to let the sample sit in the rheometer for something like a half an hour. So most likely we get back to something that looks more or less like this sort of a state.
Have you actually looked at what the sample looks like? I mean, looked through cross polars to see if it looks more like that or more like a network of lined effects or something? I mean, there's a lot of possibilities that it could be.
I can't look at it in the rheometer, but I can look at it in an optical microscope, right? Yes.
And which does it look like?
No, it looks.
It actually looks like.
Yeah, it looks like something like this, right?
Something you don't pronounce focal phonics.
Oh.
You usually have three or four smectic textures.
Yeah.
Focal phonics.
Yeah, there. You're absolutely going to have defects, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the defects could live in the middle of this domain, right? Yeah.
Ralph,
no question.
Do you think about well-defined domain walls? I mean, is it a smooth evolution? Is it just thing wanders?
That's hard to decide in our microscope, but And I think other people who look at defects would be better suited to answer that question. Yeah.
What's the typical size of this
thing? Of order microns.
Are these chains, it's chain length, and I assume they're very polyspersed.
Yes, this material is fairly polydispersed, like MW over MN of about 2.
And chain lengths of what sort of?
Well, they're high molecular weight, so I don't recall exactly the chain length for this one, but it, you know, it's something of the order of 30,000 grams per mole. So they're long.
This is a smectic characteristic. You see this in not those magnitudes, but also other smectics, right? Small molecules.
Absolutely, and I'm going to get to that if we ever get there. Right. So, what I want to do next is look at the same polymer and look at the strain dependence of the viscoelastic response. And that not only will convince you that the data I just showed you are in the linear regime, which is at low values of strain amplitude. So this is the strain prefactor in the sinusoidal strain that we're applying. And at low values, we're in a linear response regime. And then at higher strain values, we get into a strongly nonlinear regime that seems to be reasonably described by a very simple rule that would basically say that in this large strain regime, we are at a constant stress condition. And you can see that the yield strain is really quite small in these materials. And as a material scientist, I like to plot these things as, instead of in this format, as stress versus strain. And the linear response regime, of course, is described by Hooke's law with a constant modulus. And then there's a yielding point, and the large strain behavior seems to be a constant stress.
Do you have access to the stress waveform from the rheometer at these larger strains?
Yeah, and in fact, that's actually why this thing looks like it rolls off a little bit steeper than this minus one, which is not really a physical result. And that's because, you know, in this region, you're starting to get things that don't look quite sinusoidal.
But up until that point, it looks sinusoidal just with a smaller effective modulus.
Yeah, that's right. And for sure, if you deconvolve the thing with Fourier analysis, right, you would start to see non-sinusoidal aspects there. But just looking at the oscilloscope, it looks like it's still a sine wave. And even out here, it looks not unreasonable. I mean, it's a reasonable approximation to a sine wave.
Presumably at larger strains, sorry to keep interrupting, at larger strains, presumably you're not measuring only a material property because it's actually evolving. If you're at strains sort of bigger than your gamma C,
yes,
it's probably not the same structure anymore, right? I mean, in that sense, what you're measuring is something which you've done to the material also.
Absolutely. Right.
Well, if you're doing something that's at that strain, that you do reproducibly at that strain, it's the material property in the same sense as any nonlinear rheological property is.
Except possibly that now if you stop and make a linear response measurement again on the material, it's not clear if they're the same thing.
No, that's right. And in fact, we didn't do that in this particular case, but certainly if you do, say, steady shear, you're going to alter the linear response enormously.
Yeah, certainly. But even here, you can imagine that it happened. The strain is big enough.
It's quite possible. Yep. I agree. No reason to expect it to remain the same anyway. Okay, so as Pat suggested, you can see the same thing with low molecular weight smectics. You don't really need a polymer. You get a much lower modulus with the low molecular weight smectic. So this is sort of a typical structure for these low molar mass things. There's a rigid mesogen again and a flexible piece, and the flexible and rigid parts don't like each other, so they like to make layers. And this is, again, the linear response. And clearly, this material is a solid. But again, it hasn't been aligned in any way that we intentionally did anyway. We dumped the stuff into the rheometer, as Scott would say, and off to the races. So we're looking at presumably some sort of defect structure.
What happens at longer times? I mean, it just...
At lower frequencies still.
Maybe you can't do it in the rheometer, but let's say you just make a sample and you leave it on the shelf. I mean, if you turn it upside down, is it stay there for a day?
This one... If you turned it upside down in the course of hours, it would flow under its own weight. It wouldn't flow instantaneously. I'm going to show you another one in a minute. In fact, I usually bring the sample, but I managed to leave it in Pennsylvania.
It just has a long relaxation time, really.
Is that a solid?
Yeah.
No.
The term solid is.
No, it is solid. It is a solid.
Yielding.
That's right. It has a very low yield stress, but it's a solid. And we're going to look at a lyotropic lamellar one in a minute that would be it's pourable, but it's still a solid if you apply a low enough strain amplitude to it. So it's just very easily broken solid, but it's a solid. We couldn't do really steady shear on the polymer melt smectic, but we could do steady shear on this 8CB, the low molar mass smectic. And you see what I advertised at the beginning that we would expect for a solid, which is that the viscosity has a slope of -1 as a function of shear rate, which means that if we just plot the stress becomes independent of shear rate at low shear rates, which is characteristic of a solid. And in fact, if we take the modulus value times the yield strain that we would measure by ramping up the strain amplitude in the oscillatory shear experiment, we get something that agrees pretty nicely with this, what rheologists call yield stress. The other thing that I would like to point out on this overhead while I'm here is that there's a region out at higher rates, well into the yielding region, where there's a clear power law, and that power law has a slope of 2/5.
That's what he was. Which one? The stress. The
stress
viscosity. The viscosity has a slope of -2/5. Right. Sorry. Okay, then we can also look at a lyotropic lamellar phase. It's actually a cool solution that I wish I had brought with me. But it's a dye in water, and if I told you the structure of the dye, I would have to kill you. So I won't tell you that. But it's basically like a surfactant-like looking thing that happens to be a dye. And Kodak uses these things to sensitize photographic emulsions to particular wavelengths of light. So this is a 10% X-ray scattering from a 10% solution of this dye. These come from a Kratky camera, and Mike Landry helped me with these measurements. And then if we desmear them, that's what's up in these insets. So you can see there's several orders of diffraction for the 10% solution, and there's sort of a hint of some order in the 1% solution. And you can plot this spacing as a function of reciprocal of concentration. And of course, then you get a nice straight line, which is that basically as you add water to the system, you're increasing the layer spacing. So these layers just open up as you add water and get further and further apart. And of course, that eventually stops, and you wind up in a two-phase region. eventually. But there's this nice region here where it's just a perfect lyotropic lamellar phase.
Is that percent solvent or percent surfactant?
It's percent. ASD is an acronym for aqueous sensitizing dye, which is what these things are. Yeah.
And this lamellar phase is mainly electrostatically stabilized or sterically stabilized, or what do you know?
I would say it's mainly electrostatically stabilized. The only way you can get these dyes into water at all is to sulfonate them. Yeah. So it's mainly electrostatics, right? And there's no added salt or anything like that. So that should dominate things. And these ones are also solids. A lot harder to measure because the modulus is quite a bit lower. And they actually flow under their own weight, but they have a modulus of something like 10 dynes per square centimeter. The data are quite noisy, but I think it's pretty clear that they're solids, even though they're actually porous.
By conversion, is that like 1 Pascal?
0.1. No, it's 1 Pascal.
Yep.
Never know which way.
It's a factor. Those factors of 10 are tough, right?
And what strain?
That's a very good question, and I don't remember the answer. But it's probably something like 5% strain. So it may not quite be perfect linear response, right?
This is the two-phase system because we have about 1%.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but actually, if I looked at the one phase system, I get similar results. But unfortunately, I didn't find any of those in looking at my overheads last night. So we're stuck with this one. And the reason I took this one is that's the sample that I have. And unfortunately, I didn't bring it with me.
And the fact that it begins to level of Gibbs primary begins to go up is that there is another relaxation mode lower or something else is happening.
It's possible. I can't answer that question, Michael. I mean, the noise is pretty large here, right? So I it's possible that it's eventually it would. Who knows? I can't speculate what it does at lower frequencies.
But how big the change of G prime should be over a couple of decades with the color of solid versus continuously decreasing modulus? If something looks like a flat, then if I go to solid, what is the difference?
Yeah, well, it's a good point. I mean, I tend to try to extrapolate to these things to say, well, it's a solid, but.
But if you extrapolate, it keeps on going down.
From polymer melt, you can produce.
Yeah, that's right.
If this is a plateau or something else, for you would go solid.
It's a good point. Yeah.
In first transparency, you showed that the solid should behave that G double prime should decay linear, and then all plots you're showing us now is horizontal. G double prime is horizontal.
Right.
Well, a
lot of the horizontal aspect may be a measurement crisis, right? Because it's hard to resolve a phase angle that's close to 0 degrees when you have so much noise in your data.
It was only a factor of 10 difference, not even in the previous data you showed us.
No, but that's a very low torque.
Yeah, I'm with Ralph on this one.
Yeah, this is, I would not put too much emphasis on these data myself, yeah. I could measure it again and, you know, they might be up here or they might be down here or whatever.
What about G prime? What is the error bar of G prime?
I would say the biggest error is that probably this strain amplitude is slightly in the nonlinear regime. So the real G prime is probably a bit higher and a bit flatter than this, but I don't have a way to measure that, unfortunately.
What happens when you do a stress sweep? Like if you put this liquid in or solid, sorry. In a stress reactor, ramp stress, then come back down. Would it be a better experiment to get a yield stress, more conventional, and say that that's a criterion for solid?
Yeah, so you'd want to apply a stress that's smaller than the yield stress, right?
At some point, yeah, you'd want to.
Yeah, and that's hard, at least in commercial rheometers, that's not feasible for these materials. I'm in the process of setting up a rheometer that might be feasible, but it remains to be seen whether it will actually ever work.
One comment. I mean, this double prime flattening and tending to rise is actually quite common in lots of soft, messy, semi-solid things. So it's
quite possible. Yeah, I can't rule it out.
It's very widely seen. Of course, in principle, if it were true, if you could wait long enough, the things equilibrate and you go down and become what time reversal and so forth tells you at low frequencies. That frequency may be very low, or it may be aging, in which case you never get there.
So yeah. Well, I think we have to accept some sort of definition of what a solid is. And even a metal at room temperature has vacancy diffusion and whatever, and eventually that vacancy diffusion would lead to the metal flowing on time scales of order of the age of the universe. And so it would be a liquid too if you really want to be picky about it, but I would call that a solid. Okay. The same sorts of things are seen for other lyotropic lamellar things, and I'm not doing a very good job in this talk of showing you lots of data from the literature that aren't my own data, and so I thought I'd show you at least some. So this is for an anionic surfactant that forms a lyotropic lamellar phase at these quite high concentrations, and so it's actually a bit easier to measure. Thanks, Pat. And we have the slope of -1, which we expect for a solid in steady shear.
This bump in the middle, is it characteristic for squares seem to be going up and down. Well, yeah.
Maybe. Okay, so a good question is, why should we have smectics acting like solids? And certainly if we had things perfectly aligned, as theorists like Scott like to do, we would have... No, that's right. And I just spent a lot of time talking to John Toner yesterday about these things. So he felt exactly the same way. We should start with getting things just perfectly aligned and see what happens with that. But I claim that doesn't have a whole lot to do with the rheology that we're looking at in these samples. And the reason, okay, so the smectic really should act like a liquid if we have it aligned the right way, because the layers ought to just be able to slide over one another pretty easily, right? That's not quite so obviously true for the polymer version of the smectic, because you might have the polymer kind of traversing different layers and whatnot. But certainly for the other ones, it's true that they ought to be able to just slide right over each other. But the problem is there's... At any non-zero temperature, we ought to have a finite population of defects, and some of the defects that you might see go by names like this. Steve?
Yeah, so you might want to add to the top statement, it would also apply to other alignments too. You could have it in another alignment, and it would still behave like the liquid if it was defect free.
I think so.
Because it's a liquid,
and
each one of those layers is fluid.
Right.
Yep. Some alignments would be more apt to form defects with a very small stress than others.
Right.
So my background is in polymer rheology, and and this is the first example of anything that I've ever thought about using my material science training for, which is, you know, that defects sort of rule the mechanical behavior of these things. So it's a real material science problem. Okay, another layered system is block copolymers. And I was lucky enough to get Frank Bates to send me a really nice block copolymer once upon a time, and we studied that. So this is the actual copolymer. It's a saturated hydrocarbon, which makes it thermally stable and whatnot. It has an order-disorder transition temperature of 96 degrees, and below that it forms a lamellar phase. Let's see, there's certain entanglement characteristics of each block, and that part is fairly asymmetric, although the block itself in terms of mass or, well, not mass, but number of monomers is fairly symmetric. And then I list a bunch of specifics that you probably don't need to know about. The temperature dependence of chi for the system is known. And if we're at 30 degrees, where most of our data will be taken, chi times n is 12.6. So that puts us in the strong segregation regime. And the copolymers are sort of weakly stretched in this regime at this temperature.
Why do you say that?
That's barely
about 10?
Sorry?
Or the disorder transition high end is equal
to
10?
Yeah, that's right. 10.5 or something like that? Yeah.
So it's not strong segregation.
It's okay.
Very close.
What is the actual order disorder transition?
96. Well, strong and weak are relative terms, right? So you can take your pick.
It's whether the composition profile looks sinusoidal or whether it's got very big blocky domains. And if it's strong, if it's positive sinusoidal, it's weak, and if it's not, it's strong.
So I'm comparing the interface width with the lamellar spacing, and that number is small, so I say it's in the strong segregation regime, but
no.
I'm sure you could be more strongly segregated. So
you
know,
have
strong
to
and weak.
Scaling, you have to be very strong segregated medium.
This the interfaces narrow up much before the chains get significantly stretched. When chi n gets only a little bit above 10.5, you do get a relatively narrow interface. You have to go much higher.
Well, that's what he's saying, is that you have no stretch, but the profile.
Right.
The chains are weakly stretched, but the profile is pretty.
The profile is fairly.
But that's not a measurement of the interface width. That's an estimate from a scaling grade. It's probably quite accurate.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, I did not measure the interface width.
It was measured, yes.
If you had X-ray data on this and you found lots and lots of high-order scattering, then you'd know it's not like a single sine wave, but much more like something very blocky. So that's the objective way of telling, right?
Yes, I agree. I do not have, unfortunately, you know, the contrast between these two blocks in X-ray is pretty pathetic. So I've got another di-block copolymer that I do X-ray on. Maybe you can pretend that it's similar. So. The experiment that we're going to do actually is shear orient these copolymers so that we try to get we actually put the material in between flat parallel disks, and we just rotate one of the disks for a long time, many revolutions, and in the hopes of getting to some state that looks something like this. And we never get to anything that looks quite that perfect, as evidenced by small-angle X-ray scattering from a copolymer that has nice contrast for X-ray. So one block is polystyrene, and the other block looks pretty much like polystyrene, except it has a silicon atom in it. And so that gives us the contrast for X-ray. And so I'm comparing a solvent cast and annealed film, which is an example where you can really get to pretty good perfection, with the shear-oriented one. And the shear-oriented one still has many orders in its diffraction, but it doesn't have quite the narrow peak width. And so somehow you could get I think this sort of domain spacing or some sort of spacing between defects from the width of this peak. But quantitatively doing that is beyond our abilities at present. OK. So as we shear align this polymer, it's low frequency rheology change. So here we're at 30 degrees, so we're 66 degrees below the ODT in the lamellar phase. And the low frequency response changes as we shear align it. So the green one is just quenched from the disordered phase. And as we shear align it, the blue one is shear aligned for one revolution at 30 degrees, and the red one is shear aligned for one revolution at 86 degrees, so just a little bit below the ODT. And we get a progressive lowering of the moduli as we go, as we apply more and more shear alignment to the
measurements are all taken system. At 30.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the measurements were all taken at 30, right.
So why isn't red above the blue?
Why is red above the blue?
Right.
Yeah, no, in a perfect world, I'd be able, like if I had it on my laptop, I would have been able to delete the red points last night. But you know, that's the way it goes. This is the best one I found. And in fact, I used to have a really nice one that, you know, has after one revolution, after two revolutions, after four revolutions. And after about four revolutions, you know, it doesn't change anymore. Yeah, but it's an interesting question as to why the red one is where it is. And I don't have a good answer. So you see sort of subtle differences in what Mike Cates and Michael Rubenstein hope is the terminal response of this material. But where you really see big differences is out at much higher frequencies, where we actually go to a temperature sweep, where we can see since the two blocks have different glass transition temperatures, when we shear align the material, of course, then we get into this region where the layers are not perfect, but pretty good, right? And then the low TG guy can really deform a lot and has a significantly different response. So it doesn't really affect the glassy modulus of the whole thing, but it affects this modulus between the glass transitions of the two materials. Okay. So if you just did the usual lazy rheologist experiment after shear aligning the material, you might well conclude that you'd taken enough data at this point, and this material is a liquid. The viscosity is independent of frequency at low frequencies, and G prime and G double prime are approximately their slopes of 1 and 2. But if we go, of course, we already looked at this, so it's not such a big surprise. If we go to lower frequencies, we see something interesting is happening to G prime. Those data get noisy, but I don't think that's a phase angle crisis in this particular case. Our strain amplitude is 1%, and we have reasonable amount of torque at those sorts of modulus levels.
These are samples that have or have not been shear treated in that way.
This sample has been sheared for four revolutions or more, and once I get beyond four revolutions, I don't have any more changing. So I'm not sure exactly how many this one had, but
changing at tantamount state or at high frequency.
Well, that's a good point. Okay, so to get to 10 to the minus 3, I've got to have the thing in my rheometer overnight. And I don't know necessarily that there's no change out here. But there's no change down to, say, 10 to the minus 2, right?
But it seems that there's a correlation between the onset of noise and the break in the curve. Precisely where the noise begins is where it breaks away from the flow.
Okay. I can't rule that out. And so as an honest experimentalist, then you would look at these data and say, well, maybe there's something interesting going on at lower frequencies. And isn't it a shame that I can't access those longer timescales in an oscillatory experiment? But there are other experiments that we can use to access those long timescales. And so what we're going to do is turn to a different rheology experiment, still linear viscoelasticity in some cases, and that is creep and recovery. So in creep, what we do is we apply a constant stress, and we just wait. And if we wait long enough, we can access much longer timescales. We can wait months if we want to and access those sorts of timescales. And so what we're plotting here is the compliance, which is the time-dependent strain divided by the applied stress. So it has units of reciprocal stress. And it's plotted as a function of time. And we get this nice behavior here in creep. That's the solid curve. The jumps are just our resolution for measuring angle, which is going to show up at very small angles or very small strains. But then eventually we get into a slope of 1 on this log-log plot, which means that we get to the typical response of a liquid stress proportional to, strain rate proportional, or strain proportional to time, which means a constant strain rate, and we can calculate the viscosity. Then when we get out into this steady state regime, what we do is let go of the stress and watch how much recoil we get. And so that would be on this sort of a scale, you know, a little tiny blip downwards, which I am plotting as the dots in the same sense as the creep. So this is sort of the strain in this direction, the recovery direction. And you can see on short timescales, this viscoelastic part is the same in creep and recovery, which is supposed to be. And then eventually, this thing almost levels off, which is what it's supposed to do if we really got to the and accessed all of the modes available in the system. It doesn't quite ever level off, and that means we didn't access all of the modes, but it's close. So we can see whether we have linear response or not by applying different stress levels. In this case, the numbers actually correspond to torque levels, which isn't terribly convenient, particularly since I don't recall the exact conversion between stress and torque for this particular geometry. But the point is, at the lowest two torque levels, the recoverable compliance seems to become independent of torque, and that suggests that those data might correspond to linear response, whereas these other higher levels of stress or torque are clearly non-linear response.
Ralph, I'm sorry, was this on a non-aligned or an aligned sample?
This is an aligned sample also. So we're trying to repeat exactly the conditions in my creep rheometer that I had in the oscillatory rheometer. So 4 more revolutions and then start making these sorts of measurements.
How long did you wait before? So you do the pre-shear, which is a pretty violent history.
Yeah.
Now you're doing an extremely subtle controlled stress experiment.
Well, what we would do is after the pre-shear, we would treat that actually as a creep experiment, right? So we would pre-shear for a while, and then we would do the recovery experiment and see what we got back.
We had a long time before you actually.
So these recovery experiments are of the order of a day or so. Now, I don't remember the details. It could have been 3 days that we waited, because sometimes we let the recovery go a long ways. Okay.
And it's always the noise becomes big when you get close to the AG, but it was similar to the other case, right?
Yeah, well, it's the same problem, right? When you start applying really small stresses, you're going to have more noise, progressively more and more noise in your data.
But it seems to happen always when you think you're entering linear regime, when it becomes.
Well, with the oscillatory, I'm not sure it was entering the linear regime. That all of those data are probably nonlinear. Yeah. And this one, I mean, maybe they're all nonlinear, to tell you the truth. I don't know that I can really rule out the possibility that all the data are not corresponding to linear response. So we can also look at the viscosity from all these different stress levels. And this wound up with the very celebrated 1/2 power law at low shear rates. So now I've done a rheologist's nightmare, which is the Cox-Mers empiricism, because we don't really understand this empiricism. So we're plotting steady shear viscosity versus shear rate and complex viscosity versus frequency on the same plot. And these squares are all the creep data that I talked about. We also did some steady shearing experiments in our strain-controlled rheometer, where we did the oscillatory shear also. And so it seems, and these are all the oscillatory data that we looked at earlier. So it seems like that empiricism seems to work reasonably well. I believe it was Ken Schull and Ed Kramer that measured the diffusion coefficient of this material, and the diffusion coefficient at this temperature is shown on this plot as the reciprocal of a time scale at which the chain diffuses a distance of order of its own size. And you can see that you can divide the plot into two regimes based on this diffusion coefficient. There's one regime that looks sort of normal polymer-like up to the diffusion distance of the polymer, or the time scale for diffusion of the polymer, and then something that's controlled perhaps by larger length scales at longer times or lower rates. And those things almost have to be due to defects in some way. And of course, clever theorists never have any trouble getting a slope of minus 1/2. That's a pretty easy slope to get. So there actually were three predictions right away for this slope. One by Kawasaki and Anuki based on mode coupling. Another one from our friend Michael Rubinstein and Sergei Obukhov based on something or other. And Semenov also had an interesting theory based on something else. None of them are right. Okay.
We had something for concentrated dispersions. It's similar, imitation of Gauss. Yeah. It wasn't these things.
Okay. So in the time remaining, I'd like to switch to again a different system, which is a pneumatic liquid crystal polymer. Yes.
I guess I was a little confused. I thought you never showed data in which you had this minus 1/2 in linear rheological data. You showed it in creep.
Right. And it's clearly nonlinear in that case.
Your circles were turning up with almost the same slope. But that was from your linear.
But I thought there was data that showed it in oscillatory. Is there data that shows the same phenomena in oscillatory measurements?
Yes.
Yes, I think there are. I think there are data that show the slope of 1/2 from oscillatory. I mean, by luck or whatever, ours ran out of gas, right, at just the inopportune time. But you can, let's see, you would want something that's less entangled, and then you would get this defect-oriented controlled regime at a higher frequency, I would think.
There was the there were PSBI.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so these measurements exist. And I guess the other question is should I think of this?
There's a real question as to whether they correspond to linear response, but they the data definitely exist in the literature.
Okay. And should these creep measurements, this is from the lowest torque. Should I think of those creep as linear response creeps?
I think these two lowest ones are. If we ever get there, I'm going to argue that the real slope should be 2/5, and these lowest two have a slope of -1 because they correspond to the real solid response of the copolymer. But you certainly can have a tough time making that stretch based on these data. Right. So we don't want to go there yet. Okay. So pneumatics are quite interesting. So far we've looked at these layered systems. And at least the layered liquid crystals were all solids because of some sort of defect texture. Well, pneumatics have a defect texture too. And so a good question is, why aren't they solids? Because people don't really seem to think pneumatics are solids. So what we did is we looked at a main chain polyether. It's one that Wes knows and loves very, very well. perhaps not.
Well.
Yeah, you know very well, right? I mean, all these things have their drawbacks, right? So you might wonder why we made this complicated copolymer that looks almost the same, except this one has 9 carbon spacers, this one has a 7 carbon spacer. And the reason is to just widen the pneumatic range. You're suppressing crystallinity by introducing this disorder. And that makes a nice wide pneumatic range where that covers about 70 degrees. So we have a nice temperature range where we can study pneumatic rheology, basically. And when we look at the oscillatory data on this polymer in its pneumatic phase, we see a lot of viscoelasticity that persists on timescales that are much longer than the time for the chain to diffuse a distance of order of its own size, and those diffusion data were surely taken by Beth Hall at Cornell. We don't ever get to decide whether this thing's a solid or a liquid, and I think maybe it would qualify for some sort of interesting power law, and I don't know the slope of that one off the top of my head.
This stuff is not aligned again.
This is not aligned, right. Put into the rheometer and quenched from the isotropic phase.
And quench it on the, what's it called? On the
step on again.
In our rheometer cell, right. Yep. So just to remind you, if we had polystyrene, we would, of course, expect to see liquid-like response on timescales that are longer than the diffusion time. And of course, there's viscoelasticity in the pneumatic that I claim the only thing that exists on larger length scales is this sort of defect texture. And just like the block copolymer, we can turn to a creep experiment to try to analyze this pneumatic polymer. And there was a very clever student, actually, an REU student from the physics department at the University of Chicago named Lauren Netwich, who worked with me for 2 summers at Kodak. And she took these data, and I kept sending her back, do it again. So what you see is that the creep compliance initially looks like something like a liquid. So this winds up having this nice slope of 1, and we could calculate the viscosity from that. And the viscosity is of order 1,000 poise. But as we keep doing a day of creep and a day of recovery over and over again, we see the viscosity builds up systematically. And so here I've showed it after 3 days. After 9 days, it's quite higher viscosity, which means the thing didn't creep as far, and it never got to the slope of 1. So It's still very viscoelastic at the longest times we looked at. And then this thing continues to evolve and then stops evolving after about 20 days. So it's a long experiment. So we just kept doing the same experiment, creep, a day of creep and a day of recovery at a very low stress level, and eventually settle into this behavior. It almost looks like a solid, right? You'd expect a solid to come up and just level off. And it's not quite leveling off, but that means that we just have additional modes. But we can tell whether it's a solid or a liquid by looking at the recovery. And again, I'm going to plot the recovery in the same sense as the creep, but in this case, it actually would be easy to plot it in the other sense. So if we plotted it, the recovery is the one on the bottom, and basically this is telling us that all of the deformation was recovered. So if we didn't put this in the same sense, we'd start it here, it would just drop down and go like this, right? Except on a log time scale, it might look a little bit funny. Okay, so it means that all the responses, in fact, recovered, and that's a characteristic of a solid. So it means that the final state we wound up at looks like a solid. Now, all sorts of things can happen to polymers at 150 degrees that might make them solids. You might imagine that there's some interesting chemistry that cross-linked the polymer or something. But none of those things actually happened in this case. So we can get back to the starting state either by applying a higher stress level and just shearing the material, or we can take it back up into the isotropic phase and bring it back down into the pneumatic phase, and we're back to the same starting state. So there's no interesting chemistry going on. I think what happens is that these, you know, you get into some sort of stable defect texture that survives at that particular low stress level.
How close are you to this phase, this other phase transition? You said TX or something is 135.
Yeah, so there's, is it still called the mystery phase, Wes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's some mysterious phase that looks like some sort of higher order synectic from our best guesses that is, I think at something like 130 degrees. So we're a ways above it, yeah. Yeah, I don't think we have any mystery phase fluctuations, but you never know.
Have you done experiments where you didn't repeat it, but just put it in the reactor, waited for 9 days, and then experimented?
Ah, that would be an interesting experiment that we did not do. But
how much total strain has accumulated in the creep experiments for each case?
Oh. Well, at the low stress, at the beginning when it has a 1,000 poise viscosity, we're going around many, many, many revolutions. But now at the end, it's not deforming very much at all. It winds up with a modulus that's something like 100 dynes per square centimeter.
So it seems opposite. You would expect it to become more fluid, like.
Well, it depends. I think the response we're seeing is caused by defects, and in fact, the nice thing about pneumatics is they're fairly well understood in terms of Frank elasticity, and so we could understand this modulus perhaps as being something like a Frank elastic constant divided by the defect spacing squared. And somehow, you know, if you read Jacques Pro's papers or Dejean's papers, they always say this Frank elastic constant, it's always 10 to the minus 6 dynes. I have no idea where this number comes from because they...
KT over molecular size.
KT over who?
Over molecular size.
Okay.
Give or take some factor of 10.
Okay. So anyway, if we accept that, then this modulus of 100 dynes per square centimeter is going to give us a length scale that's something like a micron, which is probably reasonable. I mean, looking in the microscope, there looks like there's some sort of defect texture of order that size. So it's you know, I don't, I can't get more quantitative than that, unfortunately. But
how big a strains has it gotten to it at the per one?
Okay, well.
Two fifths.
Multiply compliance by stress.
Yes, multiply compliance by stress, and you will get strain. Yep.
Three.
Yep. Sorry. Yes.
So it would be nice then to have a little bit lower molecular weight so that your viscosity would be less, and so then your C could be bigger, and then see if you if that correlates, right?
What? Why is the V-fix spacing going to change with molecular weight?
Well, if it's less viscous, it can coarsen more.
Which is an interesting question. You've had this thing sitting around for a month in the melt. Why aren't the defects coarsening away and getting bigger? And
no, they okay. So Bernie Yerke did this stuff with low molecular weight pneumatics, right? And he saw the thing just coarsen forever. But in this case, it seems to coarsen maybe and then stop. I don't know why it stops. You tell me.
Yeah. It's creating defects at the center of annealing.
Okay. That would make the defect spacing stop changing.
The Yerke experiments, he didn't do anything except wait right after he finished pouring it into the cell and clobbering.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, the only way you want to have a stable texture, as far as people know now, is if you have a defect lattice, in which you have a perfect lattice, where you have perfect balance of forces.
Yes.
Once you get away from this perfect lattice, you will not have coarsening.
Yeah.
That's the common understanding.
But it may well be that the stress level somehow sets this defect.
You always do
scale.
A day of creep, then a day of recovery.
Yes.
So you never left.
We never stray from the path, right? And we might well get a different result if we strayed from the path.
You have initially no defect, or very little defect. Is that your story? Because when it flows like a normal liquid, it means there is no defect there.
I would doubt that there is any never a case there. There's never a case with no defect.
But you don't see that defect.
Yeah.
Somehow it goes against what people what I hear saying, because apparently the defects, there should be more defects than there should be.
Well, it may be. Well, one possibility is that initially the defects are sort of distributed randomly throughout the sample, and then as time goes on, they attract each other and form real grains like what we're seeing.
Across the sample while it's flowing down.
Good question. Don't know.
Typically, the magnetic textures don't look domain line, the distillation lines, not sort of grains like that, because it's not a solid material in that sense, right? It doesn't have crystal planes and things. So that's probably not a good cartoon. There are other cartoons you can draw.
But
effect lines getting tangled up or something.
Okay, no, that's true. Well, there's an awful lot of disclination lines, and to tell you the truth, I have a tough time thinking about what a disclination actually does. I mean, when it moves by, I'm going to get to this hopefully in a few minutes, but when the disclination moves by, nothing much happens. Whereas, a disclination or a dislocation, for instance, you get a displacement when it moves by. But I agree, the picture with pneumatics is less clear, but what is clear if you look in the microscope is there's a region over here with alignment like this, there's a region over here with alignment like this. What happens in this domain wall is a fuzzy issue, right? But I think of it as just a conglomeration of defects that are piled up there, and who knows what they all are.
So one thing that's sort of contradicts your data was that Wes has shown with VHMS79 that it's a flow aligning material, so you would expect that with continued creep, it would go the other direction. In other words, defects would be annihilated with flow.
But it depends on which regime you're in, right? If you're at higher shear rates, I think what you're saying is true. But if you're at low shear rates, where I think the thing wants to be a solid, or low shear stresses, I should say, where the thing, I think the thing wants to be a solid, then it may not be true.
You're also fixing stress, not strain rate in this case. So.
True. True, but I, yeah, no, that's right.
Do you have any idea what the underlying Wesley viscosities are?
No. Do you, Wes?
We got measurements of lambda on one rather lower molecular weight material, but nothing more.
But not the viscosities themselves, just
no. I mean, we can get an order of magnitude from the region 2 viscosity.
So we've seen lots of evidence of things that are solids. I thought I'd summarize the moduli that I showed you. The Smectic polymer had a very large modulus. Smectic monomer had a smaller modulus. The pneumatic polymer has a smaller modulus still, and if we use the usual extrapolation of polymer to monomer of 30, it looks like here, we would suggest maybe the pneumatic monomer might have a modulus as well, that it would be a modulus that's too small for us to be able to measure it with our current technologies in the linear response regime. And in some general sense, we expect maybe this modulus is controlled somehow by the spacing between defects or domain walls or something.
You've not done any measurements on sort of violently stirred pneumatic, monomeric phases to see if any of these things happen.
So violently stir it in
the pneumatic and just do something awful to it. A monomeric pneumatic, not polymeric.
Yeah, put it in the blender or something. Yeah. No, we haven't done that. I don't. Has that been done in the literature?
I have indirect results on that, but the coarsening time is
too quick.
So fast.
Yeah.
There's a piece of work with Rintiev where I think they put particles into it, and then the particle pneumatic composite is pretty solid.
Yeah. It stabilizes the defect texture at some length scale. Right. Yep. Okay, so I'd like to, in the very brief time remaining, talk about some material science ways of thinking about this sort of rheology. So this is very much borrowed from ideas I got from Maurice Clément, who unfortunately is not here this week because of some sort of illness, which I hope he's okay. But anyway, this is a very classical equation known as the Orrawan equation. And it's Orrawan was a metallurgist who studied dislocation motion in crystalline metals. And he said, I can calculate the shear rate in this metal under creep. All I need to know is the line density of defects, that's rho, the Berger's vector, or the magnitude of the Berger's vector, which is sort of the length, the small length that we're going to displace when the dislocation rolls past, and then the average velocity of these dislocations. So it's just sort of a way of calculating a macroscopic shear rate from microscopic defect motion. And possibly it applies to other line defects as well, although with disclinations it's a little bit hard because I don't think there's any displacement in particular when the thing goes by. But that's okay. My friend Maurice Clément assures me that there are also dislocations in pneumatics, and so that may still be okay.
It's
in both. So now it's really too bad that he's not here, because I don't actually know why he says that.
Certainly hesitate to say he was incorrect about anything about defects here, but perhaps something was lost in the translation.
Yeah, possible.
Wrong French language.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to use this Orrawan equation, and right away we'll get rid of this velocity by replacing it with something that we'll call mobility. It doesn't. It's really the ratio of velocity and stress, so it's a kind of a funny units for mobility. But we're going to assume that that mobility is a constant, and that lets us put the stress into the equation. And then we're going to replace this line density just by the reciprocal square of the spacing between defects. So that's this length scale C. So we have this nice Orlan equation that relates shear rate, shear stress, and length scale of the defects. And I'm going to assume that B and mu are just sort of constants. So to get a constitutive equation, we need some other piece of physics to put into this equation, because we really want a relation between just, say, shear rate and stress, for instance. So for Smectics, Clément and his coworkers decided what to do with this thing, because they've measured the modulus of Smectics as a function of the length scale of the defect spacing. I wouldn't say that their data are absolutely overwhelming in terms of proving that this sort of a law is correct, but their data are at least consistent with this law. So we can then say that the stress is reciprocally related to the cube of this length scale, and we can combine these two equations then to get rid of the length scale, and we'll have an equation for shear rate as a function of stress, which is our constitutive law for Smectics. It's actually derived by Clément, and the shear rate should go like stress to the 5/3 power.
Is there some kind of symmetric object defects to do it, say, cube, like a little spheres of holes? Isn't there supposed to be the picture just above that, right?
Yeah, well, this is certainly going to happen at really high shear rates. We don't have a good picture for what happens at intermediate shear rates. So this is going to apply in what I would call the yielding region, where we're just at stresses that are slightly above the yield stress.
Ralph, I'm getting confused. You actually gave two scaling arguments for G. One of them was that it was KT per volume for psi cubed. And the other one was that it's material parameter over size squared.
We're going to get to that, because this one applies for pneumatics and that one applies for Smectics.
I like this one better for both. Why wouldn't I have put in an appropriate material parameter over?
Yeah. It's a good question.
Smectics is because of well-defined symmetry, so it's not clear why you can assume something to be symmetric.
I agree. I am recapitulating Clément's result. But I agree with your statement. It's not obvious to me that they have to be different.
But to put it another way, I mean, there are microscopic lengths plenty around here, like the penetration length of the Smectic, and it's obvious why that shouldn't come in. Maybe you could repeat the argument whether there were experiments that showed that.
Yes, yeah. So there's an old paper by Horn and Clément. Is something like late 70s, I think. And this paper has some evidence for this thing, but then he's shown me other, you know, evidence. I'm not sure if it's published, actually, that has.
And the evidence comes by measuring G somehow and measuring the correlation length somehow?
Yeah.
So what C do they measure, actually, do you know? I mean, do they actually look at correlation length for translational or orientation order, or what? Because you might expect that there's some line defects, and it's a line tension divided by a length squared, or you have interfaces, and it's that energy, interface energy per unit area divided by length. And you can think of so many other ways of coming up with G's rather than,
That's right.
Yes.
I share that view to a certain extent. So. Yeah, he gets this nice power law, you know, with a viscosity scaling like shear rate to the minus 2/5, which agrees very nicely with the data I showed you earlier on in the talk, and lots of his own data, actually. So, unfortunately, no one's measured this defect spacing for Smectics as a function of shear rate, which would be an obvious experiment that needs to be done.
Is it known what sorts of Burgers vectors dislocations usually have? The Smectic dislocations have a tendency to clump and produce large Burgers vector dislocations, also work by Clément. That Burgers vector could then, you know, there could be some complicated way in which that Burgers vector depends on the stress. The mobility that you talk about actually is better thought of. I mean, when you talk about a dislocation moving, if you talk about mobility as a velocity over a force, that force is the Peach-Cuyler force, which in turn depends linearly on the Burgers vector. So you could actually get a lot of other results from this. And there are things that Burgers vectors probably could be measured, actually, by imaging.
Again, he would be the guy to ask that question to, and I don't know the answer, sorry. I would like to know the answer.
I think I have reasonably strong experimental evidence for that result. Or I guess three different systems?
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. Question is,
but not measuring the defect spacing, which is sort of the link between the two, right? It would be nice to independently verify that.
And the Butler's vector, really need to measure both.
Right. Okay, so what we did is we said we can apply the same sort of reasoning to pneumatics with the Frank elasticity instead of this KT over C cubed that Clément used for smectics. And that gives a much simpler result.
But
yes.
I don't understand the first half of line one. I mean, the reason in the smectic,
yes,
that you imagined that there was any relation at all between the shear rate and the motion of the dislocations. I mean, that was sort of taken from solids, i.e., you can't shear them unless they're moving. Okay. But here, as you pointed out before, I mean, there's no obvious reason why I have to move the defect in the pneumatic at all.
And what's B?
Shear it. And then what do you mean by B anyway?
Yeah, well, certainly, what you're thinking about is high stress levels where this is not going to apply. But so.
The worry really is, what do you mean by a Burgers vector for defects in a pneumatic? The defects in a pneumatic are orientational defects associated with an amount of rotation that you go around them. There isn't a displacement of the length connected to that. Because for a solid, that first half of the equation, basically a kinematic condition, it's a redescription. If all the non-recoverable displacement is produced by dislocation motion, then that has to happen. But in pneumatic, I don't know where that comes from. I don't know what it means.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that question.
You could assign a length just from the
So when a dislocation moves past in a pneumatic, you think that there's no displacement?
No, it's rotation.
But the rotation causes stress.
Rotational defects. The director rotates.
Yeah.
So you can get stresses. You can certainly get non-trivial physiology from defect motion in a pneumatic, but not through that equation. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, to make sense of that, it would seem you need to have some cartoon with, you know, one or an array of disclination lines oriented in some appropriate direction with respect to applied shear, and come up with some cartoon or other why they would move at all in any shear. That cartoon is kinematic in the solid, and by extension in the smectic, but not here.
So you know, you need a lattice or a translation. You need a structure with permanent frozen in spacing homogeneities of something which you can, and it's kind of a super lattice structure of defects imposed on the pneumatic. You shear that thing yields and moves, and you could then come up with something analogous.
No, but remember, the relevant length scales for the region that we're talking about at really low stresses is much larger than any molecular sizes. So we don't care about what the molecules particularly are doing. But then there's just some sort of network of domain walls or something. And the way that thing relaxes is by some kind of line defects, I would imagine dislocations, but I don't know, that move from one side to the other. Right?
And high defect densities, the interactions between the repulsions between dislocation lines can give this required motion of each other. So if this defect repels that one by its alignment, then a shear force may force relative motion of the defect.
What do you mean by dislocation?
Yeah, it's not clear to me what dislocations are in pneumatic side.
Over here we're saying clin, not luck.
Disclination, right. There's loads of disclinations, but they don't seem to...
No, it must actually be a network of disclinations, which is the solid-like object which you're shearing. I mean, rather than talk about...
Okay, that's fine.
If you think of it that way, then you can sort of sustain a picture something like this.
But then I think the Burgers vector is zero, so...
Most of these disclinations observed are disclination loops. And loops, they shrink most of the time.
Well,
he's going through some units there. And the question is, where does the stability come from?
But I think we have to keep these things in perspective, right? This is a non-theorist telling you about a goofy scaling argument. let's not get too worried about it, right? The interesting thing is, you know, that in pneumatics, clever people like Wes have actually measured the defect spacing, and so as a function of shear rate, and so we can at least try to hope to make some connection between why the viscosity has an anomalous power law and why the defect spacing has, maybe there's some relation between those two.
Is the claim that defect spacing agrees with direct measurements?
It agrees pretty well. I'm going to show you that in just a second.
Can I just look at your analysis?
Yes, sir.
Gamma dot, your first equation is gamma dot goes as sigma over c squared. And your second is sigma goes as k over c squared.
That's right. So I can just solve this for c squared and put it in here?
No, then there's a fourth power somewhere, right?
No.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so 1 over c squared is sigma, and so this just gets sigma squared. Yep. Even non-theorists can do eighth grade algebra, okay.
Yeah, I could have said that wrong.
right. So basically we expect the viscosity to decrease with shear rate with an anomalous power law that's interesting, and the defect spacing to decrease with shear rate with a different anomalous exponent.
At what frequencies or what shear rates?
Well, it has to be at the low shear rate end, which is what rheologists call regime one for pneumatics. But I claim that since they're solids at lower stress levels, there ought to be a regime zero as well. So this is the regime I was just talking about. That has the nice slope of a half for pneumatics and the slope of 2/5 for smectics. And these, well, we can split this curve into two parts. One part at high shear rates is the usual molecular motion of the polymer. So there's a zero shear rate viscosity and a shear thinning regime that's typical for molecular motion of polymers. And then at low shear rates, we have a defect-dominated regime, actually two of them. So at low enough stress levels, stress basically being a minus one slope here, if we march the stress up, all in these stresses, we would have a solid response. So it would obey Hooke's law. And then we have a yield stress. So now we finally applied a large enough stress to sort of start to change the defect texture. And then the defect texture coarsens as we go to higher stresses or larger shear rates through this regime. So that's the basic picture. And then we can try to look for evidence in the literature. Yes?
Minus one, has anybody seen that?
Well, yes. In fact, I showed you data for that at the beginning of the talk, or not at the beginning, not too far back in the talk, which was when we let the thing sit for a long time, it eventually got to this solid-like response, right? So presumably, we were at a stress, in that case, that's below the yield stress for the pneumatic. That's why we get a solid-like response.
Ralph, in your picture of regime one, what gives way to create regime two?
Let's see. The reason regime two doesn't persist is that.
I want to go the other way. Why doesn't regime one persist?
Why doesn't regime one persist?
Why do you have regime two revealed?
What happens at that shear rate is that. The molecules can now diffuse across the grain on the timescale of the flow.
You're talking about between half and plateau.
That's right.
The question was about if the first break.
This one?
Right.
No. He was asking about one.
I think he's asking about this one. Yeah. So that's where molecular motion gives way to defect. The defects start to dominate when the molecules can no longer diffuse across the domain in the timescale of the flow.
So your texture is getting smaller in regime one, and when it gets...
Say it again? Yeah, the defect texture is getting smaller in this regime. Mm-hmm. Right, and eventually it catches up to molecular motion, right?
But in regime two, there's still textural refinement. Is it a different...
Yeah, no, that's fine. There's still textural refinement. I would say that it... I don't know. I don't have any idea how that goes, but I would imagine it continues to... The defect spacing would continue to decrease in that regime, but it's less important because now it's the rheological response is dominated by the molecules again instead of the defects, because...
That suggests you should just compare stress levels rather than... I mean, comparing stress levels and comparing timescales won't necessarily give you the same crossover. You could just say that it's when the textural stress drops below the molecular stress.
Maybe, yeah. And it's not obviously that it has to be the same. I have to think about that. Let's hold that thought and remind me about it after lunch.
Why doesn't G1 continue to lower rates?
Well,
what pins the texture? Because the texture is coarsening as you go to lower A.
No, well,
what pins it?
There seems to be a yield stress in these materials, right? And maybe there's some stress that's required to get these defects to actually coarsen, right? So there's, if you imagine a defect network, there's some stress level that's required to get that thing to deform.
That wasn't a calculation of a half, that's what you put in. You were putting a stress to flow.
Yeah, that's right.
So what stops this picture as you go to lower? You're putting some other, you have to put some other pinning or something to get this break. If you pin your... This inclination network, then I would see if you could get a solid. But if you don't pin it, it should continue up as a half forever.
I think the defect coarsening stops.
It's because?
Well, I don't have an explanation for it because. But experimentally, that's what it looks like.
You said you would show evidence for this one half?
Yeah. Okay, so that was a long-winded discussion, so you've forgotten what these power laws are supposed to be, probably, which is a slope of a half for the viscosity as a function of shear rate and a slope of a quarter for the defect spacing. And actually, this one's, started wrong. So if we plot it as a function of stress, then we expect the viscosity to be reciprocally related to the stress, which is what these first guys do. This is Wynne Walker's PhD thesis. And these are lyotropic pneumatic polymers. And we see this blue line is a nice slope of minus one. And the other one looks like it has maybe a slightly different slope, but there's a fair amount of scatter in the data, so I don't think you can rule out a slope of minus one.
I would just raise the point that I would argue that potentially at those low stresses and low rates, it's not pneumatic, but instead it is allosteric.
Right, that's a cholesteric phase.
Ah, so this would be a bad particular example to focus on. I forgot about that. Yeah, I did read your paper that said that, actually, but I didn't think of it last night. Sorry. Now I, yep.
You can come.
That's right. So is that, that's only for which one? Hydroxypropyl cellulose. Okay. Well, we'll just scrap all those data too. Okay, so that should be a solid, maybe for different reasons or something, right?
Yeah. So again, it's different.
Right. And I think this is the same one, right?
No, that's polybenzoglutamate.
Oh, good.
I think. Oh, one of them is HPC.
So you can look at the reference if you want, or you can look at what I wrote down at the bottom here, which is certainly there's not overwhelming evidence from these data that this slope is minus a quarter. It looks like maybe it's the mean value of the slope. And actually, this minus a quarter was predicted from completely different physics.
Is that the prediction of Larson and Doi? I mean, it's a little, this issue that you raised at the very top, I think, comes into play in some of these measurements. But Larson and Doi predicts the typical relaxation scaling, which, to my mind, if you only have a single length scale, implies the minus one half shear rate power law. So I thought the minus one half shear rate power law was implicit in Larson and Doi too.
Is that right? Where did I get this minus one quarter? Problem is, I made this overhead years ago, so I don't remember what I was thinking at that time. So you think this one is what you expect from those sorts of ideas?
Yeah, I think that Larson and Doi is based on the same scaling arguments.
Makes sense. Okay.
In which case the data is not relevant.
No, so there's a problem with these data as well, which is polybenzoglutamate. So forget about the HPC, but the polybenzoglutamate at these concentrations, at least the two higher concentrations, doesn't show any anomalous shear thinning. So it's constant viscosity with texture refinement taking place. The higher concentration, 48%, that will be at least partially hexagonal.
And I see.
Hence, no longer pneumatic.
Yeah.
And that will show region one, it will show the anomalous shear thinning, but because it's hexagonal, not because of anything else.
I see.
Rice 37 cross of 25?
Pardon me?
Rice 37 cross of 25.
That I don't know.
But they should both be pneumatic.
Yeah, those two I think are both pneumatic. And so I think the one slope is around 0.2, the other is about 0.4. And when we've done measurements like this, we've gotten around minus 1/3.
No, I have yours coming up next. And Wes, of course, correctly interpreted his as minus 1/3. I don't remember the reason for minus 1/3, Wes. But
no reason. That's
I reinterpreted it with minus a quarter, and I don't think it's really any worse than minus a third, but yeah, you know.
Yeah, I have reason to doubt when that number on the y-axis gets large, the theory becomes questionable. And so the tail off you see for the larger thicknesses where that number is getting larger, I think is questionable. So I tend to emphasize more the data where the transmitted intensity is smaller. So that's probably why I went for minus a third. But take your pick. Yeah. But here again, just to emphasize the point that the viscosity is constant over this shear range. So there's texture refinement, but no.
No change. So this is region two then?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
that's
what
bad.
Pneumatic shows region one without these complications of hexagonal or cold stereo?
Well, I think the thermotropes that show region one, I haven't looked carefully. So I've tried to dig into region one in polybenzoglutamate and hydroxypropylsalicylates, and both times I reached the conclusion that it's nothing to do with being pneumatic. It has something to do with some anomaly. And I don't necessarily think that's true in the case of thermotropes, although I am concerned that your solid-like behavior after 20 days, might be something else. But your region one is I think real and something to do with texture, but not clear to me yet.
So region zero is whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think there's this region zero. I mean, it's very clear that it exists in smectics. They clearly have a yield stress and a solid-like response. The pneumatic, we haven't varied the stress level enough to really nail it, but it gives all indications that it's a solid at low enough stresses.
Did you show data for the minus 2/5 in the smectic? I don't remember anything that was clearly.
Yeah, actually, there's a lot. I unfortunately, I didn't bring all that data with me, but Clément has assembled quite a lot of data that show that, and my data actually show it as well. I pointed it out when we looked at this overhead for 8CB. Whoops, let's just look at one. And that's at this very high shear rate range, this is a nice slope of minus 2/5.
Wasn't there more than someone's thinning regime, though? Why is that the fish? Just your thinning regime.
Well, you see, you think it's region 3 or something.
Well, why would I?
I don't have any way of deciding whether it's region 3 or region 1.
Well, the molecular relaxation time would be extraordinarily short, so there's no reason to expect a regime 3.
Right. There shouldn't be any sort of molecular issues with HCV, right?
Not a polymer, we're a small liquid crystal. So
say again?
Not a polymer, it's a small liquid crystal.
That's right.
Shear thinning.
Yeah, it shouldn't, molecularly shouldn't have any shear thinning.
You can say that.
At these rates.
The relaxation time of a molecule is, you know, if we measured the diffusion coefficient of this stuff, the molecular relaxation time, the reciprocal of that thing would be way out here, right? Very short time.
Way out, right.
Okay, well, you survived the whole thing, I think, somehow. So I'll put my conclusion slide up that I think these things are all solids. There are no anomalous power laws that, as the terminal response of any material. And there are some question marks here. So lamellar block copolymers, we never really got to the solid-like behavior. Maybe we will with our next rendition of a very low stress creep rheometer. And we also don't know for thermotropic pneumatics, small molecule pneumatics, whether that's really a solid. We don't have any evidence for that, but we may be able to apply small enough stresses to, at least with our estimate of the modulus, be able to see whether these things look like solids as well. Thanks for your attention.